Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, a look at the stop and frisk policy in Detroit. A federal judge ruled the practice unconstitutional in New York City, but Detroit police plan to keep using stop and frisk. And later in the hour, a private university in Flint is buying up land in order to remove blight and hopefully reduce crime. We'll focus on this public-private partnership coming up later in the show. But first, Congress is the holder of the purse, and we've been hearing a lot about that recently. The sequester, a possible partial government shutdown, the looming debt ceiling. And really, there are no signals from the Democrats or the Republicans that anyone intends to budge from their positions. Joining us to talk about that is former Democratic Michigan Congressman Bob Carr, who is now with Campaign to Fix the Debt. First, tell me a little about Campaign to Fix the Debt. What is the group? Who are the members?
Well, the group is basic purpose is to try to long-term focus on debt and deficit reduction issues. Part of the problem, as you outlined in your intro there, is that we lurch from crisis to crisis. And this group is put together to look at the longer term and try to get us over these speed bumps and keep our focus on deficit and debt reduction.
And who are the members?
The group is made up of average citizens throughout the country. We have a Congressional Leadership Council, which is made up primarily of over 100 former Republican and Democratic members of the House and Senate who want us to focus on this issue.
Are these former members of Congress, are they mostly fiscal hawks, or how do you describe the political spectrum?
Well, I think they're across the spectrum, basically. Needless to say, I think many of them are moderates. They avoid the extremes. We're people who want to get to a compromise. There isn't everything that everyone is going to be happy with, but we do need to focus on the goal and not get lost in the skirmishes along the way.
So clearly you have some insight into these issues. You spent some time in Congress with your other colleagues. What are you and your group going to do to nudge members of Congress and the president toward getting the United States government on more stable financial ground?
Well, in terms of content, we're rallying really around the Bowles-Simpson architecture. A well-known group of people came together, under the aegis of the president of the United States. Unfortunately, he didn't endorse their product, but they came together across the aisle, across a broad spectrum of political thought, to try to forge a reasonable compromise on taxation and spending and enhanced deficit reduction. So we're really in support of that architecture, although, you know, like any good politicians, we're willing to accept changes and modifications, as Bowles and Simpson themselves are.
We should remind everybody that was a bipartisan task force that was
exactly
designed to take on these bigger issues that you're talking about, not
that's
these
right.
Short-term issues.
That forms the architecture of the content we'd like to see in terms of a compromise. But then more tactically along the way, we're trying to mobilize public opinion. We're going to have a fly-in this fall where members of Fix the Debt from across the country will come to Washington and visit with their representatives and senators to try to urge people to come together and make a deal. Let's make a deal is what it's all about. Let's try to fix this problem by making a deal that will be long-term, that will guard us against deficits and a debt structure in the long term that's going to threaten our economy.
Let's talk about some of the more immediate threats. The current continuing resolution, which funds the federal government's day-to-day operations, we could soon see a partial government shutdown if it's not renewed. Some members of Congress, mostly Tea Party members, say we should shut down the government if it helps make the point that the Affordable Care Act should be defunded. Is there a solution to this short-term standoff?
Well, I think it's going to be who's going to blink first, and I think they'll ultimately blink first, because the fact of the matter is they're in goal conflict right now. They want to reduce spending, and they want to get rid of Obamacare. But number one, Obamacare is the law. It isn't going to be gotten rid of just because you try to starve it for money. And the other aspect of this is that shutting down the government actually costs more money. That is not a cost saving. Even if you wanted to eliminate government, it costs money to get rid of government and shut it down. So they've got tremendous goal conflict in this Tea Party group, and hopefully they'll come to their senses.
There's the more serious vote on the debt ceiling that's coming up. Not raising it would mean the U.S. would default on payments. It could further hurt the credit rating. Most observers think that will not happen, but at this point you have to wonder if Congress is like a train running down the track with no brakes. What would be the consequences?
Well, of course, we'd have everything from a global economic meltdown to a hiccup. The credit rating of the U.S. government is what it is. It isn't really rated by these Standard & Poor's and Fitch and the rest of them on Wall Street. I mean, our credit rating is pretty darn good. But if we do shake the confidence of investors around the globe in our economy, in the value of the dollar, it could have global repercussions, not just domestic repercussions. We're in a global economy now, and we can't mess with that. But the fact of the matter is, we have to pay our bills. There's a whole host of things that we've bought in the past that maybe people today, thinking back on it in hindsight, would rather not have purchased. But by golly, if we've purchased them, we've purchased them, and we better pay for them. Now, the debt ceiling really is a vote that should not even be taken. The debt of the country is the accumulation of spending and taxes and whatever's left over, surplus or usually a deficit, that Congress has already embedded. Putting this even to a vote is ridiculous.
We were told by the Obama administration that the sequester would damage many of the government services on which we rely. And I don't think many people have noticed. There are a few cases or instances that you could give. What's happened so far? What could happen?
Well, we saw that some of them were more publicized, like airport and the FAA and air traffic control and a few other things. So Congress quickly moved to exempt them from or give them relief from the sequester. Ironically, of course, members of Congress board an airplane virtually every week to go to their home district, so it was very convenient for their own operation. it caught not only the public's attention, but it caught Congress's attention that strict cross-the-board, including the FAA, just wouldn't work. There have been a few other minor carve-outs, but, there's a lot that government does that is we count on, we rely on it. It makes our economy run smoother, makes our lives better, but are largely invisible because they protect us from problems. Say food safety, for example, or drug safety. These are things that are going on every single day, and we don't see them, and we count on them to be going on because when we go to the drugstore, we go to the grocery store, we want a safe and effective supply of food and drugs if we need them. Part of the problem is in our society, sometimes what isn't apparent isn't real. So it's very easy to make government the big boogeyman that's taking all of our money and we never know where it's going. And I think part of the problem is that people in office, the president, Congress, even those of us who are politically aware, don't do enough to remind people of the things that government does for us each and every day and how valuable they are to our economy and our quality of life.
You mentioned Simpson-Bowles, and you say the group campaign to fix the debt is in favor of many of the reforms in there. It was a combination of tax reform and a reduction in entitlements as well as many, many, many other things. What's going to make sense? What's practical in this Congress?
Well, it's very hard to say what they're going to figure out. Now, I think we're going to make some progress on tax reform. At least there's some hope. Congressman Dave Camp from our own state of Michigan, a good friend of mine, is the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, and he's joined there by another great friend of mine from Michigan, Sandra Levin, who's the ranking member. Michigan is in a key position with regard to taxation, because taxation is starts in the House, it starts in the Ways and Means Committee, and the top two leaders of that committee are from Michigan. So we have a real special reason to get behind these two gentlemen. And then on the Senate side, it's Max Baucus and Orrin Hatch, also two good friends of mine. I was elected with Max. And Max Baucus and Dave Camp are combining together to try to advance a comprehensive tax reform this fall, one that will reduce a lot of tax expenditures, reduce a lot of wasteful and unnecessary loopholes that have been carved out over the years as various special interest groups have tried to seek advantage in the tax code. And they've gone with a clean sheet of paper and tried to rebuild the tax code, and hopefully we'll have some of that will be on the House and Senate floor this fall. So we're watching that very carefully. We want to support their good efforts, because hopefully it will lower the marginal rates, but close loopholes and also create more equity and fairness, and also raise some revenue. Now, on the spending side, you know, there are things that the government can cut back on, if only because we want to modernize our spending. Some of our spending is out of date because it assumes conditions or technologies that no longer exist. We just want to modernize the spending and make it more rational, and do it by program by program, not this meat axe across the board kind of cutting, which really hurts.
Bob Carr is a former Democratic Michigan congressman who is with Campaign to Fix the Debt. Congressman Carr, thanks for the time.
Thank you for speaking with me, and have a good day.
Still to come, the controversial stop and frisk policy in New York City was recently ruled unconstitutional by a federal judge, but police in Detroit say they'll continue to use it. More on that story in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The city of Flint gets more than its fair share of bad press because of the crime rate and the city's financial struggles. But Flint is also known for urban redevelopment at a scale not known by many other cities. Land use is changing there. Vacant industrial areas and foreclosed properties are being purchased, abandoned buildings demolished, and the area turned into a greenway. Joining us to talk about some of these changes are Doug Weiland. He's the executive director of the Genesee County Land Bank, and Robert McMahon. He's the president of Kettering University in Flint. Kettering has been purchasing and transforming many properties in Flint. So, Dr. McMahon, first, how is the university paying for this, and what's the goal?
Well, the goal is the university is paying for it out of our funds. The goal is community vitality and revitalization of Flint. Our success as an institution is tied to Flint's success as a viable and dynamic economy. And it's important that we, as an institution, not be passive, but take an active role in doing our part to revitalize the Flint, both economically as well as the infrastructure of the city.
I understand you did get something in excess of $15 million from the Mott Foundation. Is that correct?
We did. About a year and a half ago, we received the largest grant in the history of the institution, the largest single grant, which was a $15.5 million gift.
Now, how many properties have you purchased so far, and what's that amount to in acres or city blocks?
I can't speak to the exact total. It's over 100 parcels in the city so far, and it is, in aggregate, something around 50 acres, I would think.
Doug Weiland, I've done a lot of land use stories in the past, and the Genesee County Land Bank is noted as a model for the state, if not the nation. Give me a brief description of what the land bank is, and how do you work with organizations such as Kettering University?
Well, the land bank is the organization that manages tax foreclosed properties for the county treasurer as they are come through the tax foreclosure process. Then after they go through the process, they revert to the land bank, and we're responsible for their maintenance and care and for selling the property. In this particular case with Kettering University, We were delighted when they came to us and said we'd like to start acquiring property around the university, and we had a lot of property there. I think of the 100 parcels or so the university has bought, some 80 of those have come from the land bank, and we have others on our list that will be coming. We've created a redevelopment area, what we call a redevelopment area, around Kettering and the borders of the geography that they're interested in, so that any tax foreclosed property that comes into that area, we hold it and make sure that we don't sell it to anybody else and see if Kettering is interested in the property. The work that they've been doing, demolishing houses that are, you know, blighted houses that are on these properties and greening over and maintaining otherwise weed-infested properties, has been just magnificent.
Now, we should describe this property is along the riverfront. It's near downtown. Dr. McMahon, how do the efforts of Kettering tie into other institutions such as Mott Community College, maybe the University of Michigan Flint, Hurley Medical Center, which is a nearby neighbor, and downtown?
They're a key part of that. One of the mantras that we have is to make University Avenue a walkable and economically vibrant corridor for the city. Many people who haven't been to Flint in a while would be astounded at some of the things that are happening here in terms of economic rejuvenation, revitalization. You know, downtown Flint, the Saginaw Street corridor, is a vibrant and growing economic zone. There are restaurants, and you go there in the evenings, and people are sitting outside and eating, and there are shows and other cultural activities. And our connection to that activity is along University Avenue. So one of our key initiatives as an institution is to make the University Avenue connection, the connection between Kettering and downtown, and by virtue of that connection to University of Michigan Flint and other educational, Mott Community College, the Cultural District, viable and active economic corridor.
Now, there's a large area that used to be a General Motors plant, I think it's called Chevy in the Hole, that needs to be cleaned up. That's not cheap. I know Kettering is not the only player here in that effort. How extensive is the effort, and how's it being paid for? I know there have been a couple of federal grants involved in reseeding and replanting trees and so forth. Doug?
Yeah, we currently have a $2 million grant from the EPA to do some of the additional cleanup on one of the parcels that's particularly dirty. And that one is south of the river, across from the Kettering campus. There's a lot of work going on there right now in terms of remediation. On the other large parcels of the property on the south side of the river, south of the university campus, there is going to be a large vegetative cap going over acres and acres of concrete slab where the factories used to stand. So that work is ongoing now. It's going to take several years to be done. And there's what they call a phytoremediation project on that site as well, where trees and vegetation are planted that are intended to help bring the some of the contaminants up through the soil and into the trees to reduce the amount of contamination. So it's a very, very large-scale project that will be ongoing for some period of time.
You're listening to Stateside, and we're talking with Doug Weiland. He's the executive director of the Genesee County Land Bank, and Robert McMahon. He's the president of Kettering University in Flint. Dr. McMahon, I'm wondering, right now you're basically clearing this land, replanting it. Are there future plans for development of these areas that Kettering University is buying? Are we going to see an expansion of Kettering in the future?
Well, Kettering is growing and a vibrant and dynamic institution. We, of course, are one of the nation's highest-ranked engineering and applied sciences schools, and you can't pick up a paper or turn on NPR and not hear an article about the value of engineering and science to our economic future, and particularly to experiential learning and internships and co-ops to playing an important role in creating talent and effective engineers and scientists. So in that context, we as an institution are growing, and we look forward to reinvesting and doubling down in Flint and expanding our footprint in Flint as that growth occurs. When we're acquiring these properties, not specifically with that purpose in mind, we're acquiring to do these properties really to do our part to clean up blighted areas of the city that are adjacent to the university and in the connector corridor between us and the downtown area to begin to help foster economic development along that corridor in addition to the others that are where it's occurring in Flint.
Now, there's a fairly large stadium called Atwood Stadium that was built back in 1929, and I'm wondering how does that historic stadium play into Kettering's plans? I understand you'll be operating it now, and will the community still have access to that stadium for high school sporting events?
Absolutely. In fact, it's our intent to operate it in the public interest and to increase the level of community engagement in the stadium. Atwood Stadium has a phenomenal history as an institution, going back almost to the founding of Flint, and parallels in a lot of ways the development of the automotive industry in Flint. And it's just a wonderful historic structure. And as part of our regional engagement, we have taken on that property in order to make sure that it remains a viable and community-focused parcel within the city.
Doug Whalen, I understand that the Genesee County Land Bank is within the Treasurer's Department, which is a county office. How are you working with the city of Flint, and how do you mesh your plans with private institutions like Kettering University and revitalization of the city of Flint?
Sure. Actually, the Genesee County Land Bank is a separate governmental authority, but we are closely linked to the county treasurer's office, and the county treasurer is the chairman of our board of directors. We are a separate organization. The city of Flint has been a major partner with us on most of the activities that we get involved in. We currently are coordinating demolition for the city of Flint, and with the large grants that we received, they've been partnerships between the land bank and the city in terms of the application for the funds. We have a close relationship with the city administration. We've been involved in their master planning process, and they have relied on us to produce maps and other support materials for them and documentation as they've gone through and done their new master plan.
A lot of this land is near or on the riverfront. What are the plans there? What's this going to look like along the riverfront?
Well, there's a number of different plans that have been proposed for kind of revisioning the riverfront and particularly where it flows through Chevy and the Hole. That remains to be seen at this point. There have been plans to do everything from kind of a boardwalk sort of a treatment. Currently, it's a concrete channel that was created 30 or 40 years ago, probably 40, 45 years ago now, for flood control, and it's really not very attractive. So there's been a lot of thought to trying to bring it back to nature, but at this point, there still has to be more remediation done at the site so that taking the concrete away doesn't just allow some contaminants and things to flow into the river.
Right. So,
but it's an area that if you look at it, is really quite scenic, and you can see the real potential for making it a real attribute for the city.
What kind of timeline are we talking about here? Your best guesstimate.
Well, I'm thinking it's probably going to be 5-10 years on that particular kind of a project.
So I'm wondering what the surrounding neighborhoods think of these changes. I'd like to hear from both of you. Dr. McMahon, let's start with you. What are your neighbors telling you, not just your civic neighbors, but the actual residential neighborhoods telling you about the plans of Kettering University and your partners in that region?
Well, we've been partnering with them, and we've created we were one of the organizations that created what we call the University Corridor Coalition, and that is a stakeholder group that includes the universities, but it also includes the neighborhood associations and neighbors and businesses within the corridor. And we've been partnering with them to focus our efforts in the community. I think on the whole, they're very excited to have an engaged partner. Kettering has, you know, we as an institution, we ask our students to make impacts in their community when they graduate and when they go on to their careers. And in fact, community vitality is one of our four fundamental strategic pillars as an organization. So it's important that we model that behavior as an institution, the behavior that we're asking our students to exhibit. And so part of that is working closely with the community and community stakeholders to make sure we're having a positive impact for them as well. But the short answer to your question is, I think there's a lot of very positive energy around what's happening in the corridor, And to your earlier question about the Chevy and the whole property, in 5 to 10 years, that is going to be a spectacular park greenway connector between the university and the downtown area. If any of your listeners have, you know, remember the old Pittsburgh versus the new Pittsburgh down along the river, the power of having green space and having water flowing, waterscape flowing through the middle of a town can be an enormous economic driver.
Doug Weiland, I want to ask you a question about the Genesee County Land Bank. You know, you're buying foreclosed properties, you're cleaning them up, or you're selling them to other people who are cleaning them up. But just the idea of foreclosures really kind of riles some people up. I'm wondering how you struggle with explaining to the community that you're serving why this is necessary and how it avoids blighted areas.
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, a lot of people just are plainly opposed to government foreclosing on property, but at the same time, it's a tax collection mechanism that people don't pay their taxes. They have to have some way of making sure that there's a collection method. And, you know, to be honest, most of the property that comes to us through the foreclosure process, probably 75% or more, I would guess maybe 90%, are properties that people have simply walked away from because they're already blighted, they have no value, they're continuing to pay taxes, and after a while they just get to the point where they say, why am I paying taxes to continue holding a property that I'm never going to use? They stop paying taxes, and 3 years later it gets foreclosed. So it's not really, a lot of people will run around and say, geez, it's a big land grab. It's not a land grab. It really is a situation where people are walking away from these properties. We would like nothing more than to see them stay in the property and clean them up and make the properties revitalized, but that simply does not happen in a upside-down housing market such as we have here. But it's interesting, the question you asked Dr. McMahon with regard to how the neighborhood has reacted. I can tell you that the first reaction that we had to the idea that we were going to sell a lot of property to the university from people in the neighborhood was, well, gee, we're not quite sure. We'd maybe like to buy that property ourselves. But after we explained to them that Kettering was going to be doing some demolition, cleaning up properties and maintaining them, they said, well, you know, that makes a lot of sense, and good for you.
I want to ask you one more question because we're running out of time here, but
sure.
I opened this conversation saying that Flint gets more than its share of bad press because of crime rate and the city's financial struggles. Given these widely publicized problems, how do you think these changes will affect the city overall? Are we at the dawn of a turnaround for Flint because of this kind of work? I'd like both of you to take a shot at that question.
Well, I'll take a shot first. The answer, I think, is yes, that the you know, people are starting to see the fruits of work that have taken place in the near downtown area and downtown, and that has been when you start seeing old buildings revitalized, such as the Land Bank Center building that we're in, that we revitalized, the Durant Hotel downtown, the Barrage Hotel that we've revamped into 21 apartment units. All of these efforts are making a difference. It's much, much harder when you start dealing with residential neighborhoods, and especially in 34 square miles of the city of Flint, where we have an awful lot of blight and a lot of overgrown properties. But you have to start someplace. And with the Kettering and the University Corridor activity, this activity now is expanding out from downtown and around more of our very, very important institutions. And people can start to see are starting to see the results of that work, and they're pleased with it.
Dr. McMahon?
A resounding yes to that question. Flint has a lot of work to do, and we have many challenges. But what gives me the most, gives me the greatest sense of resurgence in Flint, really beyond the infrastructure developments, is the investment of people and their time and their energies in the community, because rebuilding a community is a community effort. It's a shared journey, as a big sign on the side of one of our buildings says. It's a journey that we all have to take and invest in, and one of the things that gives me the great confidence that Flint is resurgent is the number of people that are moving back into the community, professionals and people who are vested in the community in one form or another who are moving back to Flint to be part of the rebuilding and rebirth of Flint. So I think the future of Flint is very bright, actually. And there's a lot of evidence on the ground and in the eyes of the people in the community to support that.
Dr. Robert McMahon is the president of Kettering University in Flint. We also heard from Doug Weiland, the executive director of the Genesee County Land Bank. Thank you, gentlemen, for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman is leaving office, so a presidential search committee has been appointed. But unlike past times, this committee does not include a student. Is something lost from the search if students don't have a say in their new president? We'll ask that question in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. A federal judge recently found the New York City police force's stop-and-frisk practice unconstitutional and discriminatory. Detroit's stop-and-frisk policy is based on the same advice from consultants at the Manhattan Institute, who also advised New York City. Despite the judge's findings, Detroit Police Chief James Craig says the stop-and-frisk in Detroit will continue and that the police will adhere to the best policing practices as called for under a consent agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. MLive reported Chief Craig says anytime the police stop someone, it's documented and it's based on reasonable suspicion. The American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan has called on the Detroit police to end the practice. In a three-page letter, the ACLU called stop and frisk a prescription for an avoidable local disaster. Joining us now is Mark Fancher with the ACLU. Mark, let's start with the basics. What is stop and frisk?
Stop and frisk is actually a lawful police procedure. In 1968, the Supreme Court, in a case called Terry versus Ohio, ruled that when police officers have, as they term it, articulable facts, which would lead them to conclude that they have reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime is afoot, they have every right under the Constitution to stop an individual, to ask questions, and to otherwise determine whether crime is actually underway. If they also have reasonable suspicion that the individual is carrying a firearm, they have the right to frisk that individual and to determine whether, in fact, they have a weapon on their person. The problem with the practice as it was implemented in New York City is that the police officers were violating all of the guidelines that were laid out in the Terry versus Ohio opinion. Specifically with respect to reasonable suspicion, in the opinion, the court said that you can't base reasonable suspicion or say that you have it if you just have a hunch that the individual is engaged in crime or might be engaged in crime. But nevertheless, in New York, officers were told that a hunch was enough and that they could stop anyone just based on that level of suspicion. In addition, with respect to frisk, the officers were told that they had license to pat someone down, even if what they determined was, even if they determined that an object on the person probably was not shaped like a weapon or did not look like one, and if they patted them down and it felt like something other than a gun, then they could go in and try and search for it. And the specific example given was of an ink pen. They said that it's conceivable that a gun could be shaped like an ink pen. So we have not even talked about the instructions that they were given on race, but the court in New York concluded that these practices were so blatantly in contradiction with the guidelines laid out in Terry that they could not be upheld.
So we've heard the guidelines. We've heard what happened and went wrong in New York, except for the race factor, and we'll get to that. Walk us through a typical event in Detroit. How does it work in Detroit?
Well, that's something that we don't know. We only know that the police leadership claims that they comply with Terry. And, you know, if they do, then there is no basis for us or anyone else to object, because that's the law of the land. But what does concern us is that they have engaged the Bratton Group and the Manhattan Institute to develop a stop-and-frisk program for their traffic control unit. And they are reported to be the organizations that developed the stop-and-frisk program in New York City that was found to be unconstitutional. So it troubles us that in the wake of an opinion which slams the practices in New York, that the Detroit police are still willing to have these organizations develop a stop-and-frisk program for their traffic control unit. And we've urged them strongly to abandon these groups and to look elsewhere for guidance in developing an approach for their traffic control unit.
Now, New York's stop-and-frisk was found unconstitutional in part because it disproportionately targets African-Americans. Detroit is 88% African-American, so it seems even random stops would end up being heavy on African-American stops. Is there a difference between what was going on in New York and what is happening in Detroit?
Well, again, we don't know what is happening in Detroit. We only know what they say they plan to do in terms of developing a new stop-and-frisk approach for their traffic control unit. But with respect to race, the population, the demographics of a community really play no role in determining whether racial profiling is going on that's unconstitutional. You know, under the law as it exists, race can be a factor in determining whether it's appropriate to stop someone. So, for example, if there is a burglary suspect who's been observed by a witness, and the description given of that suspect is that he's a black male, about 5 feet 5 inches tall, with a scar on his right cheek, and he walks with a limp. If a police officer, while he's undertaking surveillance of that neighborhood, spots an individual who's about 5 feet 5 inches tall, has a scar on his right cheek, walks with a limp, and happens to be black, then all of those things together provide him with reasonable suspicion, sufficient to stop him and to investigate and to find out if, in fact, this is the suspect. However, what that officer cannot do is to stop every black male that he sees simply because they are black. And that is precisely what the officers in New York were not only instructed to do, but which they were doing. And over the course of 8 years, they stopped more than 4.4 million people. And blacks and Latinos accounted for 83% of the people who were stopped. 88% of the people who were stopped were let go without citations or arrests. So that's the problem when you identify race as the sole factor. So it doesn't matter, even if you're in a community which has a population which is 100% black, if the only basis for stopping people is the fact that they happen to be of African descent, then that's unconstitutional. That's racial profiling. And it can happen as easily in Detroit as it can happen in any other community with a population which is very different.
I'm sure you've had discussions with people who feel that stop and frisk is a crime deterrent, that it helps reduce the crime rate. I wonder what your response is to that.
Well, I think the statistics speak for themselves. You know, in New York, they stopped 4.4 million people, and they let 88% of them go because they couldn't find anything or any reason to cite them or to arrest them. So how effective is that? I mean, what happens is that when you begin to base your stops solely on a person's color, then you end up stopping an awful lot of innocent people. And while you're spending time interrogating a lot of innocent people who are simply trying to go to work, pick up their kids from school, or maybe jog around the block to get some exercise, then the people who are committing crimes are able to operate unmolested, free to do whatever it is that they do without police watching them or looking at them. And that's the problem. So reasonable suspicion can be a good thing because it forces the police to really make a determination as to whether crime is actually afoot. And if they're undertaking that level of surveillance, you know, as opposed to a lazy approach, which is, well, this person happens to be black, this person happens to be Latino, let me stop them. They're going to be much more effective.
I want to note, I've read in some of the New York case reports that in some cases, yeah, people were stopped and they were ticketed or cited, but it wasn't because they were carrying a gun or because they fit the description of some crime. It's because they might have a bag with a little bit of pot in it or something like that. So it's not all major criminals that we're talking about who were arrested in this stop and frisk scheme in Detroit. So Chief James Craig indicates there might be some policy adjustments, but the practice would continue. What kind of adjustments can be made that would deal with the concerns you have about stop and frisk?
Well, the only thing that we're concerned with now, we just have two concerns. One, that they not listen to the Bratton Group and the Manhattan Institute because their approach has been discredited. And two, that they comply with Terry versus Ohio. If they do those things, we have no basis to complain about anything. So he has provided assurance with respect to Terry versus Ohio, but we've heard nothing about their plans with respect to these consultants. And as long as they're on board, then we feel that there is a real risk of a problem. You know, he has implied, if not stated explicitly, that regardless of what is recommended to him, he plans to comply with the guidelines laid out by the court. But for us, that doesn't make very much sense, because if, in fact, you engage someone to provide you with advice and you pay them money to do that, and ultimately what you have to do is to make your own decisions about what kind of a stop and frisk approach you're going to pursue, it seems like money wasted and time wasted. And that's, you know, something that I'm not sure that the city of Detroit can afford during this time of great financial crisis.
Mark Fancher is the racial justice staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. This spring, the president of the University of Michigan, Mary Sue Coleman, announced she's leaving that post next year. The U of M Board of Regents appointed a presidential search advisory committee this summer, and this time it does not include a student. Matt Nolan is an attorney and the director of Dow Corning's Political Action Committee. He is the former student assembly president at University of Michigan, and he sat on the search advisory committee that chose Coleman to be president. How many years ago was that, Matt?
That was 11 years ago now. It's hard to believe it's been that long.
Now, in most of these searches for presidents at major universities, they usually have a student representative. This time, seven people on the committee. They're all faculty members. Some of them hold administrative positions as well. Why? What are they going to be missing when they don't have a student on board?
Well, you know, the way that I think about it is that a university is not a corporation, right? I mean, there are some analogies, and I think that there's an instinct to think of them that way, because you have a president who's running things sort of like a CEO. You have a board of regents, which is sort of like your board of directors. And you could theoretically think of the taxpayers of the state of Michigan as the shareholders of the University of Michigan. But the piece that's different and the piece that I think you miss with this approach is that you have hundreds of thousands of alumni around the world who are all intimately connected with the university, and students are not customers. If you were to take the analogy of a corporation through, they would be, and you wouldn't ask customers to sit on a search committee. But students are an integral part of what a university is. In fact, they're the reason that it exists. So I found a lot of value 11 years ago, and I think that the committee found value just from the idea of having a student in the room to remind the candidates that are being interviewed that, you know, their purpose is not purely maximizing revenues and making balance sheets balance.
What did you bring specifically to the search committee? What qualities were important to you when you were doing the search for a president at the U of M?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, it was a great experience. There were 15 of us, and we had staff members, we had professors, we had alumni, and then we had myself as a student. And the perspective that I tried to bring was just, you know, being in that room with candidates, or as we reviewed resumes, thinking about the presidents and their role in making the campus a place for students to learn and a place for students to come out of there better than they came in. And so, you know, part of the value is purely just representation, right? Sitting in the room and being a part of that conversation.
A reminder.
But it also comes through the questions that I ask. You know, how does the president interact with the students on campus? What are the sorts of programs that they like to see? What are the ways in which they value teaching roles versus research roles? Those sorts of things that students have a relatively strong opinion about that are questions that may or may not get raised without them in the room.
So why do you think the Regents decided not to have a student on the search advisory committee this time?
Well, you know, I'd be speculating a little bit if I tried to put thoughts into their heads. And I do applaud the efforts of the Regents to try to find other ways to get input from students and other constituents of the university community. If I had to guess, I would probably look at the coaching search for the football coach at the University of Michigan in 2007. You know, the two highest profile things that a university does from a hiring perspective are hire a university president and hire a football coach, as crazy as that may be. And in 2007, that process included some leaks. It included lots of rumors. It included, if you believe, sort of popular reports or books that have been written coming out of that afterward, it led to changes in candidates that were on the table or not on the table. And I think that through that process, when you looked at our more recent high-profile hiring of a head coach, they managed that in a very different way, and I think liked the result that they got. And so if I was reading through those tea leaves, I would probably say, the university got burned once recently, and so are being a little bit more conservative this time.
Now, this process to find a new president will include several forums that will offer opportunities for all kinds of people to have input. In fact, a student committee has been appointed to find out what qualities the student body wants in the next president. Will that be enough?
Well, you know, it all depends on how those groups are used and on what sort of, influence and things that they have. I do think that there are a lot of ways for students to voice their opinion in the process. The thing that was unique for me was being able to be in that room with all of those other stakeholders. You really get a broader view of what the University of Michigan is and its role that it plays not only in the state of Michigan, but in the world. It's not just a few professors and some students. You've got a $5 billion-plus budget, only 5 or 6% of which comes from the state of Michigan. And being able to sort of have that fully contextualized conversation allowed me to leave that process with a much greater appreciation of what the University of Michigan is and what the president has to do. To the extent that contextualization can happen through these committees, that their input really will be heard and valued and used by the search committee, then maybe you can get a good portion of it. I don't know that it can be perfect, but what I've said for the last couple of months, and I'll say it again now, is that I think for the University of Michigan Regents to choose not to have a student or alums on the search committee is fine. But I do think that because it's different than what happened last time, at a minimum, an explanation of what their logic is would sort of in order. Making that decision is one thing, but why not explain it? You and I shouldn't have to speculate on why a student is involved this time. We should be hearing from the Regents on why students weren't involved in that way this time.
Matt Nolan is a University of Michigan alum. He's a former student assembly president, and he was the student voice on the search advisory committee during the last search for the president of the university. As we noted, there will be no student on the search advisory committee to replace Mary Sue Coleman. Thanks very much, Matt.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson. Hi, Peg. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. The program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.